Chapter 1. How to Marry a Billionaire. When I met Melania Knaus in 2003, we were both 32 years old and walking the hallways of Vogue. I was working. She was visiting. Stars, power players, and models came through the offices all the time. I'd seen her before, but I didn't know her yet. My boss was Anna Wintour, editor-in-chief of American Vogue since 1988. Current artistic director for Condé Nast, Vogue's publisher. Anna is universally recognized as the most formidable and influential figure in fashion. She's the creator and the subject of global media coverage, a driver of the industry's economy, and despite her Devil Wears Prada reputation, she wields her power for good, raising a fortune for charity and promoting the fashion business around the globe. Anna would be just as instrumental in the creation of Melania Trump as well. How did I get to Vogue? Right place at the right time. My first job out of college was at Sotheby's, the famous auction house where collectors and art lovers would come to more than 85 live auctions annually. In 1993, I started as a lobby girl, welcoming clientele and giving them assistance. Within 6 months, I was the third assistant to then chief executive Diana Brooks, who would later plead guilty of price fixing in 2000 with rival auction house Christie's. In 1998, I was invited to a dinner hosted by two Vogue editors, Alexandra Couture and Kimberly Ryan, for the launch of a new cell phone. I spent a good portion of the evening with them, sharing stories about growing up with two older brothers, playing pickup basketball games, and then later playing in college. I told them I had a communications and broadcast degree and was interested in finding a new job. They told me about an open position in Vogue's public relations department. If I was interested, they said, I should reach out to them. Alexandra gave me her card. When I got back to my apartment that night, I updated my resume, and the next morning, I called to schedule an interview. Until that point in my life, I hadn't yet been seduced by the world of fashion or lured into the industry. I cared more about my pants having a 36-inch inseam than I did about the brand or label. I needed to prepare for my interview. Much research was required before I stepped into fashion's minefield. At that point, I didn't read style magazines. I occasionally flipped through them. I knew about Anna Wintour, but I had to study and learn who Anna was, because truthfully, I didn't know exactly what made her the most influential woman in fashion or the most feared. The day of the interview, I spent more than 2 hours at Condé Nast headquarters, then located at 350 Madison Avenue. After my human resources check-in and interview, I was shuffled around from office to office, stopping for a while with Lori Jones, Vogue's managing director. Anna hadn't yet returned from her lunch meeting, so I was asked to wait in the reception area. I was mesmerized and transfixed by the women and men getting on and off the elevators, one more poised than the next. Then I saw her. I got a glimpse of Anna as she exited the elevator and disappeared around a corner. My hands got a little sweaty as I sat there waiting. Like clockwork, Anna's assistant appeared. "Anna's ready to see you now," she said. In her 2-inch heels and perfectly hemmed skirt, she escorted me down the long, narrow hallway. Everyone moved out of our way when they saw her coming. The right side of the wall was covered with clothing racks filled with bright colors. The left side was crammed with people trying to get to and from somewhere all in a hurry. I was taking it all in and captivated by the action. The only time I felt this transfixed at Sotheby's was when I was in the middle of a bidding war during an auction, competing for ownership of a piece of artwork on behalf of a client. I was so caught up in the moment, flying through the hallways, that I didn't realize we'd reached our destination. We stopped abruptly, then stood in the doorway waiting for Anna to look up. On cue, her assistant announced me, "Anna, this is Stephanie Winston." I walked toward her, stopping in front of her desk, a natural barrier between us. It was modern, sleek, and immaculately organized. I noticed a Starbucks coffee cup with her smudged lipstick around the outer rim. I could feel her eyes on me, checking me out from head to toe. I looked the part in my blue Ralph Lauren pinstripe pantsuit, my uniform. Anna stood, and I extended my hand and we shook, firm but not pulverizing. I towered over her. "Hi, Miss Wintour. Thank you for taking the time to meet with me," I said. She said, "Hello, Stephanie," cool British tone. I waited for her to sit back down, and then I sat across from her. I shuffled around in the chair for a moment, pulled my shoulders back, and sat up straight, thinking, no one stays here for long. The chairs weren't made for comfort. They were sleek and strong, just like her, as I would soon learn. I knew Anna's time was valuable. I reminded myself to keep it brief, concise, and precise. I'd already passed the litmus test. For starters, two of her top editors had vouched for me, and I'd already been vetted by Vogue, or I wouldn't have been invited to the dinner for the launch in the first place. My experience and qualifications were already on my resume, as well as my professional and personal achievements. So, what did we talk about? She wanted to know about me. "Tell me about yourself," she said. Without missing a beat, I said, "I stand out from everyone else." The room fell silent. She stared at me, probably waiting for me to finish my sentence. But just as quickly, she asked, "How?" "I was referring to my height," I replied. This time, the room fell deathly silent. It just popped out of my mouth. A joke at a time like this? Anna waited for more. "I like to play basketball, and I'm a black belt in martial arts," I said. I told Anna that I began attending karate classes when I was 3.5 years old, with my mom and two older brothers, Gordon and Randall, 5 days a week. In so many words, I explained how my biological father had left us after his nasty divorce from my mother, and it was my karate instructor, Young Ki Hong, who became my father figure and who taught me discipline, respect, and focus. I assumed she was curious about my last name, so I laid my family story out on the table. My mom then married Bruce Winston, son of Harry Winston, of jewelry store fame. Bruce loved mom and my brothers and me, and we loved him. When he asked me to become his legally adopted daughter, there were no words to express my happiness after the loss I'd felt being abandoned by my father. I said yes immediately. His name replaced the old one on my birth certificate. A few other pleasantries followed. 2 hours later, back at work in my office at Sotheby's, I answered the phone and heard the magic words, "Anna Wintour would like to offer you the job." I gave my notice, and 2 weeks later, I walked out the door and never looked back. For my first 2 years at Vogue, 1998 and 99, I was the manager of public relations. I answered phones, took minutes, opened mail, made daily Starbucks runs, and set up PR photo shoots. My first week on the job, I was setting up a wedding shoot at Cipriani Wall Street for a spot on the Today Show. I was responsible for the gowns and accessories. After the camera stopped rolling, my superiors left me there with the 20-pound steamer, 15 black garment bags, and all the shoes and accessories to deal with. Before they took off, my direct boss looked at me with contempt in her eyes and a snarl in her voice and said, "Just because you're a Winston, don't think you won't be carrying all of our bags. See you at the office." I wasn't born a Winston. Everyone assumed incorrectly that I'd grown up draped in diamonds, and I was labeled as one of those girls, privileged, spoiled, entitled. Actually, none of this was true. I was a worker, not a slacker. That woman obviously knew nothing about me. I hauled everything back to the Condé Nast office building at 350 Madison, no problem, no complaints. 2 years later, she was gone, and I was just getting started. After 2 years in public relations, I became the founding director of the Special Events Department, which would produce all of Vogue's events and projects in-house instead of outsourcing them. I produced and oversaw the Metropolitan Museum of Art Costume Institute Gala, known as the Party of the Year, and the Oscars of the East Coast, and approximately 50 other events and projects each year for the magazine, including private dinners, benefits, and parties in New York, Paris, and London, plus Vogue's Fashions Night Out events, Seventh on Sale, and the VH1 Vogue Fashion Awards. During my tenure at the magazine, I got married and had 3 kids. Juggling a family life and a demanding full-time job was a real pressure cooker, but it was all I knew. Sleepless nights, distinctly unglamorous hard work, and nursing all 3 babies, not at the same time, at my desk was just a part of the job. I never sat on the sidelines. I loved a challenge. Under Anna, Vogue introduced 3 spinoffs, Vogue Living, Men's Vogue, and Teen Vogue. I was responsible for organizing the launch event and several projects for all 4 titles. The workload was heavy and constant. People outside Vogue noticed my work ethic. I got calls about other jobs. I didn't make any major decisions without consulting Anna first. Her opinion mattered to me, and her insight was invaluable. It cost me a couple of opportunities, but I have no regrets whatsoever. Anna's edict within Condé Nast was famously no poaching. The early 2000s were an exciting time to be working at the magazine. The worlds of entertainment and fashion were merging, and Vogue was the epicenter. It was super intense. Anna's editorial vision, coupled with her imperial management of the employees, and content was the stuff of legend. Day to day, Vogue staffers were actively engaged like troopers, rolling up their sleeves, no assignment ever too big or too small. You would never hear anyone say, "That's not my job." The senior staff members, handpicked by Anna, would meet with her daily and often. Solutions, not excuses, were expected. She preferred scheduled meetings, but I tended to be a drop buyer more often than not. I would quietly walk up to one of her assistants' desks to ask to be put on the schedule, as if Anna didn't see all 6'1" of me standing right outside her office doors. Was she nuclear winter? You bet she was. Anna was that and so much more. She could also turn an ice storm into a field of sunflowers if she so desired. Her influence and creativity are undeniably what set her apart from everyone else on this planet. Anna's notorious 1,000-yard stare isn't just a stare. She really is looking that far ahead of everyone else. Thanks to Anna's mentorship, I had a front-row seat to learn about the business of fashion, publishing, and advertising. Bottom-up, top-down, and every angle in between. You can't sell magazines without a great story, and stories need characters, usually lovely, aristocratic creatures with global appeal who would inspire readers' imaginations and fantasies. Anna had, and has, great instincts for talent and was extremely selective about which personalities to put on the cover and to welcome into the inner circle. My office at Vogue was right across from Anna's, and within eye and earshot of my friend, the larger-than-life editor-at-large, Andre Leontali, one of the fashion industry's top arbiters of style and culture. I hadn't met anyone quite like Andre, whose flamboyancy was addictive, fierce loyalty was self-evident, and knowledge of the world of fashion and art was contagious. No matter where he was, he always held court, draped in custom-made silk caftans, adorned with gold braid and wearing crocodile shoes custom-made by Manolo Blahnik. Anna relied on his advice, and I admired his extraordinary ability as an editor and was in awe of how he balanced his spiritual, ambitious, and eccentric lifestyle. From the moment we met, he took me under his wing and helped me navigate the landmines, from seating placement dramas to wardrobe malfunctions that awaited me. One afternoon, I saw Melania Naus was at the office, having a private meeting with Anna. Part of my job was to know all the players, to research them and learn whatever I could about them. I needed to know more about Melania than I already did, which was that she was the Slovenian model girlfriend of Donald Trump. I knew more about him, of course, the businessman who loved to see his name in print and on the sides of buildings. They'd been together for 3 years, during which time she had gotten her green card and moved into the penthouse of Trump Tower. Trump and Anna were friendly. They had met over the years at New York Society events. His daughter, Ivanka, his favorite, had even been offered a job at Vogue after she graduated from Wharton. Donald needed the perfect setting to roll Melania out of relative obscurity. And what better than the city's biggest, boldest spotlight where the fashion, entertainment, and media universes collided, the Met Gala. The event was the ultimate setting for the who's who. Not just anybody could make a grand entrance. Melania was no industry power broker, but Donald was. Did he somehow convince Anna to turn Melania into the magazine's shiny new object? Before her Vogue makeover, Melania was a very pretty young woman who seemed like she was playing fancy dress-up, more brunette Marilyn Monroe than a Jackie O. After Melania's makeover, Andre's achievement, she was transcendent, high fashion, editorial worthy. The makeup, the hair, the jewels. She truly was ready for her moment. I was an innocent bystander for her makeover to a small extent, in that she and Andre were photographed together by Patrick Demarchelier for a New York Magazine article titled "The Charity Ball Game," which featured my work on the Met Gala and all of Vogue's labors to jigsaw the event together. Melania was sweet, gracious, and smiley. Andre and I agreed. We like her. We started taking Melania to lunch together at Michael's, the C&B scene Midtown restaurant, where Andre would hold court. We talked about what and who was hot and what was not. She accompanied him to many of the right cultural events he'd been invited to attend while sculpting her image. As her stepdaughter Ivanka Trump wrote in her 2009 self-help book, The Trump Card, Playing to Win in Work and Life, perception is more important than reality. If someone perceives something to be true, it is more important than if it is in fact true. Let the other guy think what he wants. This doesn't mean you should be duplicitous or deceitful, but don't go out of your way to correct false assumptions if it plays to your advantage. Perception means everything to this family. Melania became Andre's plus one. He brought her to a Martha Graham performance, so she was suddenly perceived as a woman who appreciated modern dance, even if she had no idea who Martha Graham was before she arrived. Suddenly, Melania was invited to Fashion Week shows and being photographed with Andre and Anna around town. The timing was not coincidental. 2004 could have been called the year of Trump. On January 8, 2004, the first episode of the first season of The Apprentice aired on NBC. The creator and producer, Mark Burnett, a former British paratrooper and one-time Beverly Hills nanny, cast Donald, the man who declared bankruptcy four times and would do so twice more, as a brilliant businessman, richer than God, a real American maverick tycoon, who will say whatever he wants, Burnett told The New Yorker. He takes no prisoners. If you're Donald's friend, he'll defend you all day long. If you're not, he's going to kill you. And this friend killer became the host, the boss, of a competition show where aspiring businessmen and women schemed and fought each other for his approval. A suit and tie cage match. Americans couldn't get enough. The show was an instant cultural phenomenon. Trump's brand went from has-been to superstar. As many would say later, his name recognition and TV stardom were the reason he was so popular with the voting base that elected him as the 45th president of the United States. I have only recently learned that Melania appeared on one of the first episodes of the show, giving a tour of the Trump Tower penthouse to some contestants, including a very young Omarosa Manigault Newman. The penthouse's design aesthetic, the Palace of Versailles. As the contestants marveled at the gold everything, one said to her, "You're very lucky." Melania's reply with a smile, "And he's not lucky?" Touché. She knew the value of her beauty. She wasn't lacking self-esteem. I'll give her that. I never watched The Apprentice. While swaths of the country were tuning in every week, getting prepped for the boss's eventual presidential run, I was deep in preparation for the upcoming ball only 4 months away. The Met Ball was always on my mind. I called it my baby, and I lived and breathed it all year long. I've chased runaway peacocks through the Temple of Dendur and coaxed a wasted Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols to sit down and shut up among thousands of other miracles of diplomacy, working with oversized egos and high blood alcohol concentrations. I loved my job. The 9 years I produced the gala were the highlight of my career. I was addicted to the feeling of accomplishment I got every time I pulled a happy ending out of a pit of chaos. Mixing and matching stars from the worlds of fashion, entertainment, sports, finance, and government, along with C-suite types, top execs in corporations and institutions, was part of the job. Beyond the glamour of it all, the bottom line mattered most. It was financially beneficial for the museum. I was very flattered to read what people said in a 2008 profile of me in Avenue. Harold Coda, the Institute's curator in charge, said in the article, "Stephanie is straight-talking, yet always charming, and she effortlessly balances the needs of the museum with the evening's more creative impulses." Anna called me General Winston, saying, "Stephanie marshals her troops and leads the charge. It takes a year of planning to make the evening happen, and Stephanie never misses a thing. She pays attention to every single last detail." That was my life at Vogue. Excitement, drama, pride, and joy. And so, so, so many dresses. Without question, the gala was the mountaintop, fashion's Mount Everest. My days were filled with conference calls, rapid-fire email exchanges, and back-to-back meetings. The 2004 theme was Dangerous Liaisons, Fashion and Furniture in the 18th Century. So I anticipated lots of crystal, silk, décolletage, hoops, and probably wigs. As we neared the Costume Institute G-Day, the offices at Vogue were like Grand Central Terminal. the staff, aka Anna's army, and I were managing the hysteria, the frenzy, the opulence, and diva behavior straight out of The Devil Wears Prada. I knew author Lauren Weisberger well. If their body was taking up a seat at the gala, it was my job to know everything I could about them. My own office was cyclone-struck. Guest lists, production materials, piles of color-coded Excel spreadsheets. The garbage overflowed with seating charts, dried-up Sharpies, and crumbled Post-it notes. Blue for men and pink for women. The guest list of 700 was star-packed. It included Madonna, Mick Jagger, Jennifer Lopez, Scarlett Johansson, Prince Charles, Natalie Portman, Serena Williams, and Renee Zellweger, to mention a few. The waitlist had more than 200 people, all of whom were dying to attend and willing to pay thousands per ticket. In 2019, tickets were $35,000 apiece, and a table for 10 people ranged from $200,000 to $300,000. I played an integral part behind the scenes in raising money for one of the only self-funded curatorial departments at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and in transforming a New York City philanthropic event into the global cultural event of the year. During my tenure, the millions we raised paid to maintain and renovate the Costume Institute. I'm proud of that. People who could easily afford to buy tickets begged to purchase them, but it was by invitation only. Donald always stuck to the minimum with two $1,500 individual tickets, the cheapest available, as did his daughter Ivanka, then 23. Donald intended to use his golden ticket to win the Met Ball that year. But to do so, he needed a masterstroke that would raise his and Melania's stars above the rest. He needed Mark Burnett, the TV producer who'd already given him a comeback and turned him into a star. No one knows how to grab attention like Burnett, producer of The Apprentice, The Amazing Race, and Survivor, and later Shark Tank and The Voice. Both Donald and Mark believed in taking action and letting the results speak for themselves. I believe that, together, they mastered the art of seizing the moment and came up with a storyline for the red carpet that night. Donald and Melania get engaged, a Mark Burnett production. But first, Melania needed to look the part. Fortunately, they already had the perfect Vogue-approved gown checked off their list. In celebration of the December 2000 issue of Vogue, featuring Nicole Kidman on the cover, Anna hosted the premiere of Baz Luhrmann's Moulin Rouge at the Paris Theater in New York City. The evening was my responsibility, as Melania would say, from A to Z, including the screening, a performance with can-can dancers, a dinner, and finally an auction at Brasserie 8.5 on West 57th Street, right around the corner from the theater. Anna, the visionary extraordinaire, never just threw a party. There were always many layers to her events, like a Napoleon, and the endgame was much sweeter. It was almost always about raising money for charity. I asked 8 designers, including Helmut Lang, John Galliano, Oscar de la Renta, and Dolce & Gabbana, to create garments reminiscent of what Belle Époque courtesans wore, which we would auction for the benefit of the Council of Fashion Designers of America Vogue Fashion Fund. All the items were magnificent, but the pièce de résistance was a one-of-a-kind black gown by Donatella Versace. Thankfully, I knew how to run an auction by the time I left Sotheby's. After working for Sotheby's president, I was promoted to manager of client services and then became a member of the Sotheby's private client group, where I worked with clients on purchasing and consigning in all collecting categories. I was involved in several high-profile auctions, such as the Duke and Duchess of Windsor auction and the Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis estate auction, which raised $34.4 million, luring thousands of bidders who wanted a piece of Camelot for themselves, a glass, a photo, a car, a rocking chair. Time came to Sotheby's for a story on the auction, and my photo ran in the magazine. Compared to those enormous productions, auctioning 8 custom-made garments would be a piece of cake. But I did plenty of reconnaissance anyway. I'd learned the importance of knowing who I was dealing with, the personalities, the likes and dislikes, and the size of their egos. To guarantee a bidding war for each garment, I would play to the bidder's vanities. I worked with Baz Luhrmann and his team to set up a mini-stage. For spectacle and glamour, I asked Hugh Jackman to serve as the auctioneer. Thanks to some pre-auction calls I made, the bidding got heated between Donald Trump and Harvey Weinstein, then a movie producer, and now, infamously, a convicted rapist, over the Versace dress. I think Harvey had intended to give it as a gift to Nicole Kidman. Melania didn't wear the black Versace gown in public in 2001, 2002, or 2003. It was as if they were saving it for a special occasion, when everyone would be watching, like the Met Gala in 2004, when Donald was on top of the ratings. The production continues. The Fifth Avenue stage was set with a sprawling red carpet. Donald knew that the party inside the museum wasn't nearly as important as the stairs leading into it. That stretch on Fifth Avenue on the first Monday in May is priceless real estate. If you were seen and photographed there, you were in. You'd made it. That was a matter of fact. Having invested only $3,000 in tickets, Donald will get invaluable and priceless publicity, using the paparazzi and journalists covering the red carpet to bestow superhuman powers on him and his woman as they ascended the steps. The players were in costume and makeup, Melania in her Versace, styled by Andre, Donald in a black Brioni tux. As they stepped out of their limo into the spray of photographers, Donald announced to the press that he'd proposed on the way over and told Melania to show off her brand new 15-carat, per the New York Times, $1.5 million graft diamond ring. The price was controversial. The New York Times reported in 2005 that Trump paid only half price for it. In 2018, Forbes said that Donald had lied about getting a discount at all. Most of the guests at the party were oblivious to Donald's proposal until the following morning, when it was splashed across the front page of the New York Post, the daily paper owned by Donald's buddy, Rupert Murdoch, who did his part in the whole production. Gossip columnist Richard Johnson wrote, "Melania wore the bauble, mingling happily with hundreds of guests who didn't notice the massive sparkler on her left hand. At the event, I heard someone refer to the ring and say, 'I guess dreams really do come true.' Diamond aside, all I could think about was how radiant Melania looked. Andre must have sprinkled pixie dust all over her." That Monday in May, a star was born. No, I take it back. A star was made. It took a lot of work by a lot of willing and some unknowing cohorts, but Melania's coming out was perfectly choreographed. She was thrust onto the fashion world's most iconic stage. Her unveiling was Vogue ready. The world got a good look at Donald's intended, and they liked what they saw. You could call it a magic moment, or you could call it making a deal. Donald had, as he would say, turned deal-making into an art. This deal was, he would give Melania the fashion world's answer to the Olympics. She gave him companionship, arm candy, someone whose body parts he could brag about on Howard Stern's radio show, someone to put him in the middle of a pseudo-model sandwich with his daughter Ivanka on the other side. By getting engaged to Melania, Donald would be seen by his middle America audience as a good man, a decent fellow, the marrying kind. She wasn't so naive as to think that their relationship didn't serve a purpose for each of them. But as I'd come to see as our friendship grew closer, theirs was a kind of love, nonetheless. From that night on, the newly engaged couple's social calendar was full. They went to the CFDA Fashion Awards at the New York Public Library and the Whitney Museum of American Art's annual gala. The more time I spent with Melania, the more I genuinely liked her. Being with her was like having the sister I never had before, but a really confident, perfectly coiffed, ultimate older sister. In her world, nothing was a big deal and everything was just as it should be. Just being with her made me feel good. She had her shit together. She was all about her family, Donald, Baron, and her parents, and herself. I was attracted to her directness. Despite her thick accent, she always got her point across, with a look in her stunning blue eyes, her magnetic smile, or graceful gesture. Later that summer, in July 2004, Andre was on assignment to escort Melania to Paris Fashion Week and help her find a wedding gown. In a sit-down interview with Robin Gavon, fashion critic for The Washington Post, he said, "Melania was very impressive," as they hunted down wedding dresses at couture houses. "She was not the arrogant Mrs. Trump. We went to a fabulous dinner at Valentino Chateau. I was sitting next to Melania, and she was so impeccable in her manners, in the way she spoke to people, and she was so charming." Melania chose a couture bridal gown, a 16-foot veil, and a 13-foot train, designed by the House of Dior's John Galliano. It's been reported that Donald paid $100,000 for it. Per Vogue, the white Duchesse satin gown required nearly 300 feet of material, took 1,000 hours to make, and required 550 hours of labor just to do the hand-stitched embroidery with more than 1,500 crystal rhinestones and pearls. Mere days after the triumphant season 2 finale of The Apprentice, The next production from the dynamic duo Hit Machine was Donald and Melania Get Married, a Mark Burnett production. I received my Tiffany & Company engraved wedding invite and was amused that the wedding would be on my birthday, January 21st. I'd heard rumors that Donald's intention was to throw a lavish, over-the-top extravaganza, and through endorsements and sponsorship deals, discounts and bartering, he would somehow turn a profit. He made a million-dollar deal with Getty for the photo rights, which the company would turn into huge profits by selling images to magazines and newspapers around the world. The New York Times reported that Trump bartered for discounts from jewelers, caterers, and florists in exchange for being a part of the high-profile wedding. My husband David and I flew down to Palm Beach for the wedding, met up with some of our friends, and saw Anna, Shelby Bryan, and Andre there. I wore a strapless floor-length gown with gold leaf details on ivory chiffon by my friend Hervé Pierre, then the artistic director with Carolina Herrera, who designed several of my Met Gala dresses, and is currently Melania's stylist. I heard that, at the pre-wedding dinner for Donald's special guests, the groom spent most of his time with Mark Burnett, of course, and casino mogul Steve Wynn, who has since stepped down as chairman and chief executive of his company, Wynn Resorts, over decades' worth of sexual misconduct allegations. In the morning, while Melania got ready for the wedding, Donald played a round of golf with his son, Don Jr., and Access Hollywood host Billy Bush. On the links, he allegedly said, "I keep forgetting I'm getting married today." The service was held at Bethesda by the Sea, the 1925 Gothic Revival-style Episcopal church in Palm Beach. The vibe outside was circus-like, pure spectacle, with celebrities in black tie wall-to-wall and hundreds of fans lined up outside the church to catch a glimpse of the magic couple and their famous friends. Camera recording devices were banned among the guests to prevent any photos from being leaked. Rumor had it that Donald had tried to make a deal to broadcast the wedding live on TV, but Melania had put her foot down. Melania's sister Inez was the maid of honor. Don Jr. and Eric Trump were the best men. Mark Burnett's 7-year-old son, Cameron, was the ring bearer. Two memorable moments at the service. When Donald recited the vow to honor and obey, for richer or poorer, everyone laughed, and when pre-Jared Ivanka read some scripture. The more than 400 guests included Prince Albert of Monaco, Derek Jeter, former New York mayor-turned-Trump personal attorney Rudy Giuliani, Russell Simmons, TV news host Matt Lauer, Kelly Ripa, Tony Bennett, Barbara Walters, Simon Cowell, Katie Couric, Paul Anka, Shaquille O'Neal, Kathy Lee Gifford, P. Diddy, Usher, Heidi Klum, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and the Clintons. After the ceremony, we celebrated at the Trump's 20,000-square-foot, renovated for $35 million ballroom at Mar-a-Lago, Trump's Palm Beach, Florida resort. The reception was the first event held there. The decor was as expected: garish, golden frills, chandeliers everywhere, and a spotlight trained on the Trump family crest. When we walked in, I remember saying, "Oh my God." The flowers, thousands of them, were incredibly beautiful. It was just so much extreme, competitive energy opulence, like, my ballroom is bigger than yours. As we circled the room, taking it in, we heard snippets of conversation like, "He got a deal on that. I heard he got the flowers for free. It's so over the top, but I kind of love it." People joked about the extravagance, but with affection, as if Donald were in on the joke. Andre was in his element, cutting through the crowd, listening to the ladies, looking at what they were wearing, having a great time. There was no sign of future enmity between some of the wedding guests and the groom. Although it's hard to imagine now, in 2005, Donald seemed like a harmless egomaniac. He wasn't yet the divisive force he is today. I can't say whether Bill and Hillary Clinton genuinely respected Donald Trump then, but they showed up and ate roast beef and lobster rolls that Trump said Jean-Georges Vondrichten provided for free. They drank the Cristal champagne we heard had been donated. Billy Joel serenaded the guests with "Just the Way You Are" and made up lyrics about Trump to the tune of "The Lady is a Tramp." It was a joyful celebration. There was a sense of being at an event, capital E. My group and I had a blast. My husband's such a great dancer, and whenever I can relax and let him lead, we have the best time. The setting was so surreal. It felt like we were on a movie set like Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Melania and Donald skipped a honeymoon. He told the New York Post, "I don't want to go anywhere else because this is the best place to be." Instead, he played golf at his resort, While Melania could probably have been found in her favorite spot at Mar-a-Lago, a treatment room getting a facial from facialist Tammy Fender, whose holistic botanical products Melania relies on heavily. As incredible as it might seem, Melania's I made it moment was still yet to come. Her ultimate validation and glory, what every model dreams about, came when she was featured on the February 2005 cover of Vogue, photographed by Mario Testino, the only bride in full wedding regalia in the magazine's 115-year history to date. The billion-dollar bride bounced million-dollar baby Hilary Swank from the coveted spot. Along with the cover, the magazine devoted 14 pages to a feature by fashion news director Sally Singer called How to Marry a Billionaire. I remember reading that headline and thinking, ouch. Sources said the cover coup was dependent on Melania's revealing the dress prior to the big day, which she had clearly agreed to. The story covered the nuptials as well as the apple of Don's eye, the smashing 34-year-old Slovenian, and her year-long journey to her American royal wedding. Andre reflected on the wedding in 2017 in that same interview with Robin Givon. I've never seen any woman except Melania Trump who can walk for hours or stand in 4.5-inch stilettos. She wore them in her wedding all through the night. And the fairy tale continued the following year with the next logical chapter. Donald and Melania have a baby, a Mark Burnett production. In 2006, pregnant with Baron, Melania was photographed for Vogue by famed celebrity portraitist Annie Leibovitz. In the photo that ran in the magazine, Melania wore a gold bikini and gold paint on the steps of Trump's private plane. Donald sat in the front seat of a $188,000 Mercedes-Benz SLR McLaren nearby. Leibovitz was later quoted at one of her book signings. Melania brought that gold bikini. You have to understand Melania loved taking that picture. Trump was blasé about where he should be. I didn't make it up. I met them on the tarmac, the plane was there, and I saw the graphics of the stairway, and I put Melania in it, and the rest is what it is. They love that. Before she met Donald, Melania was single, striving, with an uncertain future. 10 years later, she was polished, married, a Vogue cover model, a mother, and an American citizen. 10 years after that, she became First Lady of the United States. Looking at Melania's transformation from a distance, I can see clearly how many players and influencers were involved in her seamless creation. Millions of Americans watched The Apprentice. Donald was a household name, a flashy brand like no other, and he needed a woman who looked and played the part and let him be the star. He used his ace in the hole, Anna Wintour, to bring Melania up to snuff. He used Vogue, a distinguished brand, to create a star, not just Melania, but himself as well. If his bride was a Vogue cover model, it legitimized him, too. The Trumps resembled a close enough version of the true product to convince people who couldn't tell the difference. Donald, who has been called the King of Bling, taught Melania how to master the perception of prestige and influence. Rolex, the luxury timepiece brand, is called the King of Watches. Donald is a Rolex man. He owns a gold Rolex President, the same watch that was worn by Lyndon B. Johnson. I was there at the beginning. I witnessed the transformation of Melania from gold plate into 24-karat gold. I believe she had the heart to match, that she was genuinely caring and loving and worth all of our attention. Throughout our early friendship, she lived up to what I saw in her. Watching her now and seeing that only the gold shell remains, I have to wonder if that's all she ever was. And I was the sucker who bought the fake watch on the street corner.